serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest this time is 95-year-old Robert Bradley of Albuquerque, New Mexico. He grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota during the Great Depression. He headed west after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor to help in the construction of LSTs at Kaiser Shipyards in California's Bay Area. Drafted into the Army, he served in the 691st Ordnance Ammunition Company throughout Europe. Eventually, Bob became the company clerk, and in that role, he had the privilege of typing the unit's war history, which he cleverly subtitled, How to See the World the Hard Way. From Scotland to England to France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and eventually Germany, the company oversaw the distribution of everything from rifle bullets to 105mm shells, mines, and explosives. In a bit, we're going to hear about this retired school teacher's most recent adventure in completing his book, The Centurion's Manuscript. But first, I want to go back to where we left off before the break. So you mentioned that it was big news when the word of these concentration camps came out. Do you remember having a reaction to that? How you kind of processed that or tried to wrap your brain around what had happened?
Just a feeling of horror, you know. The Nazis were even worse than we had imagined.
And you didn't see any of those camps, but as you guys moved across, you did come into contact with people who had been prisoners of the Germans, who were liberated from prisoner of war camps?
Mostly that had been already in France, but we saw some in Germany too, yeah. Same thing. The Russians were never treated as POWs. They were treated as slaves. And they didn't care whether they lived or died.
It's got to be a little jarring to see and understand that those kind of people were treated that way.
It was.
I guess I should ask you, I have no idea what the answer will be, but if you think back about that time that you spent in Europe during World War II, is there an incident or two that you look back on and say, you know, that was a pretty close call. That could have been it for me. If things had gone a little differently, I might not be here. Do you have any of those moments?
Oh, that explosion that took place on July 12th down in Normandy, the one I told you about, that was certainly, could have been my demise, me and Phil.
Who's Phil?
Phil Brown, that worked with me at the depot entrance, routing the trucks. Phil was Jewish, and he knew some Yiddish. So a couple of times we talked to ex-prisoners of war, Russians, who also knew German, and he was able to converse with them, and they told us their stories about how they'd been treated, and schlag, and they beat us and beat us and beat us.
And if I remember right, when you told that story about July 12th on Normandy and that explosion that killed 30 guys, I think you said you ran and ran and you didn't look back. Does that mean there was stuff flying through the air in your direction?
Yeah, it was. It was flying in every direction. And most of it didn't explode. It just scattered. And then the next day, as I said, when we came back, there was shells and cartridges and stuff all over the ground for hundreds of yards around.
What about VE Day? Do you have a significant memory of that time when you found out the Germans had surrendered?
I sure do. I had a pass to Paris from Munich. We were stationed south of Munich by that time. And I got there, I think, the evening of the 7th. And the next morning, and they put me in a hotel, and I got up next morning and walked out. And I went to the Place de la Opera, and there was a drunken American major on the steps of the opera singing some stupid song. And there were a few other drunks around still celebrating. And I was just standing there watching, and pretty soon this officer approaches me, a first lieutenant, Silver Bar, and I salute. And he just starts a conversation with me, an ordinary conversation. So I said, what's going on? Officers don't usually strike up normal conversations with enlisted men. I was just a corporal. But he just talked to me like I was an ordinary person, not a member of the Army. So we had quite a conversation there. And pretty soon, two young women approached us, hesitantly. They saw we weren't drunk. They saw we were having a normal conversation. They saw we weren't drunk. They saw we were having a normal conversation. And they wanted to show us around Paris. They were students at the Sorbonne, I guess. And so for the next two or three days, they escorted us and showed us. We took the Eiffel Tower and here, and we took the metro every place. So here's this first lieutenant and this corporal and these two Parisian young women touring Paris the next 3 days. And it was very interesting. It was fun.
That sounds a whole lot different than what you'd been living for the last year.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Was there some sense of relief that it was over, or was it? Did it seem too good to be true?
Sure, we were glad it was over, and hopefully we would be on our way home before too long, but it was a while yet.
Was there a concern that you were going to be sent to the Pacific?
That was always in our minds.
So when did you come home, and what did you do in the interim till they shipped you back?
We were stationed for a while in May and June near the German town of Kempen in a schoolhouse. And then they detached me to a little town, St. Hubert by Krefeld. And I got a girlfriend there. And it was amazing how eager the German girls were to take up with the enemy. I mean, there was no hesitation. And then I didn't even get a chance to say goodbye. I suppose our relationship lasted about a week. And then one day a truck pulled up and the driver said, "Jump in, we're on our way to Munich." So I had to go and couldn't say goodbye even to her. And I had another girlfriend in Munich. That lasted longer. But it was amazing. All that Nazi propaganda went down the drain, I guess. 12 years they'd had of it.
Well, they saw the alternative, I guess. Well, what was it like to come back home, to come back to America after spending so much time overseas?
It was nice. I got home on December 31st, 45. They had what they called the 5220 Club. For 52 weeks, you could draw $20 a week. $20 was like $200 today. So I enrolled in that, and I got maybe a few weeks, and then I decided that I heard about the GI Bill, so I decided I better go back to school. So I enrolled at University of Minnesota, and 4 years later I got my degree.
So after studying anthropology as an undergrad and then as a grad student here in New Mexico and field studies that you took part in other countries, you added to your wide base of knowledge on cultures, on religions, on history. And all of those experiences, it sounds like, kind of feed into this book that you've been working on for a while. You told me that you'd like to introduce it by reading the description that readers can find on the jacket of your book, The Centurion's Manuscript. Let me remind everybody, they can link to the book online at Amazon or any of the other major book sites, and I have it linked at hometownheroesradio.com. So go ahead, Bob.
An archaeologist unearths an ancient manuscript buried in the ruins of the Galilean town of Capernaum. It turns out to have been written by the Roman officer, the centurion of the title, whose servant Jesus had healed. The centurion, upon retirement, fascinated by Jesus' apparent power, researches all he can learn about the itinerant Jewish preacher. He interviews all who knew him and collects their writings, eventually composing the now rediscovered manuscript. Upon the centurion's death, his son buries the work in a sealed container to protect it from the rampaging Roman soldiers. There the manuscript lies until found by one Noah Leipzig, Ph.D., circa 1960-something. And, shall I read the epilogue? This is the slave that Jesus healed. Eventually the centurion adopts him as his own son. His name is Demetrios. I, Demetrios, once the slave of the centurion and military tribune, Claudius Lucius Rufus, now a freedman and his adopted son, am he whom Jesus healed, one of many. I was at the time about 14 and suffered from a burning fever. It was already the third day, and I was so weak I could barely sip water. My master showed his love for me by tending me faithfully. I had lost consciousness, and he despaired of me, when, hearing that Yeshua was again in Capernaum, and disregarding his pride as a Roman overlord of the Jews, sent forth to seek my healing of this itinerant rabbi. Luckily for me, the town elders were well disposed toward my master, for though firm in his enforcement of Roman edicts, he had also shown mercy toward them, even contributing a sum of money toward the repair of their synagogue. I had come to love my master, for he had taken me off the streets of Caesarea when I was 12 and trained me as a personal servant. I had been orphaned at the age of 10 and had lived dirty and hungry on the streets since that time, begging and stealing to stay alive. His care quickly won my devotion, for I came of loving Greek parents who had reared me gently but who had died of cholera when themselves were still quite young. My master gave me my freedom at 18, but I was happy to remain in his service, and when I was 21, he adopted me as his own son. From the moment at which Yeshua spoke to my master, my fever and paralysis left me. I burst into profuse sweat, regained consciousness, and soon was able to eat. Within a day, I began to walk, and soon was returned to my normal good health. From that moment also, my master determined to learn all he could of the life and work of Yeshua, and after retiring from active service, he began his researches. I sometimes accompanied him on his shorter journeys, but mostly was left in charge of his house and goods as they traveled to Ephesus, Antioch, Athens, Corinth, Alexandria, Thessalonica, Patmos, Damascus, and as far as Rome. There he paid a last visit to his family, as well as interviewing Claudia Procula, the widow of Pontius Pilate. My own testimony is this, that I assisted my father in bringing together the many notes and documents he had collected, and copied them all out in Greek myself, and I helped to prepare his final manuscript, writing all in my own hand. Every word written here was verified by my father, as from the lips or the hand of those who had known him, Yeshua. To the best of my knowledge and that of my father, we have given a true account of his life and teaching. I further testify that from the moment of my healing, I became a believer in the word of Yeshua, at first in ignorance and out of gratitude, and later from a more intimate knowledge and understanding, having full access to all the records of his words and acts. For there is no other name given under heaven whereby men might be saved. Signed, Demetrius, son of Claudius, Lucas Rufus.
So if people pick up a Bible and they read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're going to see some parallels. They're going to see some stories where it aligns and some where there's a little different perspective to the same story, others that appear just in one and not the others. And so this book kind of pulls all four of those together.
In the places where there seems to be a contradiction, especially in the stories of after Jesus' crucifixion, the visits to the tomb and the various appearances of Jesus after his resurrection. Those differences are minor, I think. And very often in other passages where Luke says this and Matthew that and Mark the other thing, if you weed them together, they complete each other.
They were written for different audiences.
Yeah, they were.
I guess I've got to ask you, too, as I heard you read that, and that's written at the end in the perspective of the slave who was healed and then adopted by the centurion. Is there someone in the book, is there a character in the book who you identify with in your own personal journey?
I hadn't thought about that. I suppose the centurion, if any.
Is that because you've taken a similar journey of investigation, analysis, and then come to a conclusion?
I never thought of it that way, but now that you mention it, that seems to make sense, yeah.
The people who decide to read this, is there something you hope that they get from it?
Yeah, I hope they get the message that Jesus brought, which was that salvation, that is, salvation basically from death, is available, because that's what he brought. And, of course, his ethical teaching is magnificent. There's nothing else anywhere in literature like the Sermon on the Mount. It's absolutely one of a kind. And it wasn't extemporaneous. You could tell a great deal of thought and organization went into it before he delivered it, supposedly, to the... I call it the mountain discourse.
Well, and if there's anything else that, you know, that comes to mind that you'd like to share, feel free. But I want to make sure I say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us about your experiences in the war. Is there something, as you look back over 95 years now, that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm happy about the book. I hope that it reaches people. I don't care much about the money, although that would be nice too. But I'm too old to be greedy.
Should we expect another book out of you?
I have one that's completed, and I'm debating whether I can afford to go ahead with it. I think Page would publish it. It's called The Memoirs of Loki. You know who Loki was? Yeah. The Norse god of mischief and evil deeds. It's called Loki's Saga. It's complete, but it's in a kind of a rough typescript.
You know, with the popularity of these movies the last few years that Marvel makes that have Thor and Loki as characters in them, there might be a market for that. Loki's a pretty popular guy, believe it or not, as twisted as that sounds.
Tell me about that.
Loki's got a lot of fans out there.
That's interesting to know. At the very end of the book, it turns out that Loki's story is actually being told by a skald, that is a Norse poet. He says these missionaries, these black-robed missionaries coming down, coming into our country from Italy, and they preach a doctrine that's of forgiveness and love and compassion. Whoever heard of such a thing? That's the last line of the book. Whoever heard of such a thing?
Well, maybe that's a bit of a spoiler, but by the time that book ends up in print, I'm sure it's all going to be fresh to everybody who reads it. And we'll keep an eye out for that one. I'm pretty sure my daughters might even read that one, given their affinity for those Avengers movies. You never know where these conversations are going to lead us. You never know what those young Americans who survived World War II would end up accomplishing in all the years that followed. But today, not only did Bob Bradley remind us that you're never too old to publish your first book, but he helped us understand a role among those 16 million Americans in uniform during World War II that I'm guessing you hadn't heard much about or even thought about much before. Don't forget to check out the photos and the link to his book at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.